So I'm going to be rude and keep my phone on. That's actually for your protection, not mine. Okay? I'm going to try and keep this down to 66 minutes. Last time I was here, I actually wore my collar. I'm an Anglican deacon, and I think that last time I ended up causing some people to have heart palpitations and apoplectic fits. So I didn't wear it today, but I serve at Christ Church, which is the oldest Protestant church in the Middle East, and it's an absolute delight to be able to come here and share as part of the this series on the suffering Messiah. So I'll read the portion from the Gospel of Luke, his version of the Transfiguration event, which is Luke 9. Starting at verse 28. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his exodus, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and told no one at that time what they had seen. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So we are in the season of Lent. For a lot of people, they don't observe Lent, so it doesn't matter. But that doesn't stop it still being the season of Lent. It's an old English word for guess what? Spring. And it's this 40-day fast, which arrives at a festival called Easter, which is also a word. Got lots of Germans here, yes? What's Oster in German? Oster. What's the name of Austria? Österreich, right? Oster is the old German word for spring. That's why we call Easter, Easter. It is not named after a pagan goddess. If that's something you've read on Wikipedia, please delete that page. Okay, what do we call the spring festival in Hebrew? Pesach, or other one, Chag Aviv. Chag Aviv Sameach, the festival of spring, happy festival of spring. So we're in this season called Lent. It's this fast. And in the ancient church, that is that time period where you had Jewish believers in Yeshua gathering in with their Gentile believers in Yeshua, what they would do is during this time, they would examine the life of Jesus. And they'll try and mimic it. Try and do what Jesus did. Now, Jesus fasted for 40 days. And there were other periods of fasting for 40 days. The Ninevites fasted for 40 days. There were these other 40s that appeared, the wandering in the wilderness, things like that. So they decided that if Yeshua did it, we will too. Not only that, we'll put it on our calendar and we'll put it before Pesach. We'll do it before we have Holy Week. And so on Pesach, on that day, what they would do is they would save up all their converts. That was a good word back then. It's not a good word anymore. Okay, But they would. And they would, so all these people who were thinking of coming to the faith, they would save up their baptisms for Resurrection Sunday as a symbol of this new life that they have in the Messiah. They would prepare themselves ahead of time. They would fast. But not only would they fast, their sponsor or the guy who was leading them to faith, he also had to fast as well. So they track together. So if you wanted to share the gospel, you better get ready to suffer, people. Okay? And then on the day of resurrection, they would get baptized and they would join the community once and for all. It's actually a very beautiful picture. Nowadays, we don't do it that way. That's something the ancient world did. And a lot of people, particularly in the Protestant world, we kind of took this Lenten calendar idea and threw it away. Why? Because it was Catholic. Okay? And we forgot that actually sacred calendars is a very Jewish thing. In fact, we inherit sacred time, the idea of sacred time, sacred calendar from the Jewish people. And the older traditions tend to preserve that. And in the early Jewish messianic movement, we added things to the calendar. Can you do such a thing? Man, that's a good question. Well, when I read Leviticus 23, which is a great book, I don't see the Chag Purim there, do you? No, it's not. But we've got it in the calendar now, haven't we? Why? Because God did something. And if God did something, that's incredibly special. And you should probably remember it. In fact, God likes us to remember stuff. What is the first commandment that God gives his people when he gets them out of Egypt? Right? With a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, God has reached down into Egypt to a group of Israelites who know nothing about him. Right? What do the children of Israel know about God for the 430 years they've been hanging out in Egypt? They don't have a Bible. They don't have a prophet. They don't have a temple. They don't have a priest. Moses is just about to appear on the scene. What do you know about God? Okay, there's a guy called God, and he made the world, and the world went bad, and then there was a boat and a rainbow, some wandering nomad, and now we're all here. But it's when you didn't know God, that's when he saved you. Now, isn't that nice? Which is exactly the same theology that you see in the New Testament. Or as Paul would say, while I was a sinner, Christ died for me. It wasn't that I read the Bible and went, oh, this is fantastic. And then Jesus goes, good, going to go hang on a cross now for you, Aaron. It's already happened. Okay, so God gets his people out of Egypt, and the very first command he gives them is what? You see, in the Middle East, we always ask questions. That's how you teach. It's Jewish history for 500. So what command did God give his people? Go make a calendar. Exodus 12, that's a paraphrased version. Exodus 12, he says, you mark down on your diaries that this is the 14th of Aviv, and you make sure that next year you celebrate it. Why? Because if you don't, you'll forget what I did. Now, you might not forget all the people that are coming out of Egypt. You might not forget, right, the darkness that covers the earth. You're not going to forget the sand as it comes up and starts biting all the people as bugs. And you're not going to forget the screams of the women when they wake up and find all their children dead. But your grandkids are going to forget because they never heard it. And I don't want you to forget because I did something incredibly powerful. And so they put it on a calendar. Purim, God did an amazing thing, did he not? We're going to celebrate it. And so at Christchurch, we do it by doing a play. So if anybody's doing nothing on the 11th of March, on a Wednesday night, you can come to Christchurch and we will retell the story of Esther in a play. Last year we did it as Fiddler on the Roof. This year we're doing it as Robin Hood. Okay, so we're going to have Robin Hood and his merry men and Mordecai somewhere in there. I'll do that. Come along, because we want to remember redemption. When I read Leviticus 23, I discover that Hanukkah's not there. Right? Because God did something. And so we better put it on the calendar. And so we have this tradition of adding things to our calendar. And so we're in the season of Lent. It was added to our calendar. And it involves a period of fasting and praying. And we always start with this thing called Ash Wednesday. We get together and we do a little ceremony. We read Matthew 6. It's always that portion of scripture assigned for that day where Jesus says, when you fast, do it like this. Oddly enough, there's no actual command in the Bible to fast. In Leviticus, it says, deny yourself, whatever that means. We interpret that to be a fast. So by the time of Yeshua, fasting was a real part of the disciples' walk. In fact, in the early church, the early Jewish believers, we fasted twice a week. I know, because living here for 20 years, you always get people who come to Jerusalem and say, Aaron, I want to be just like the people in the book of Acts. I want to be just like the first church. And I go, I don't think you do, because you'd be liturgical. You would have liturgical services and prayers. You would have a lectionary reading. You don't get to read whatever you feel like it. You have to read what the daily portion is. And you'd be fasting twice a week. You ready for that? No. Great. Jesus also says, when you pray, pray like this. Again, there's no command in the Bible to pray. But people were doing it. Jesus is doing it. So just because there's not a command in there, we've got traditions of what we do, how we do it, when we do it. And so the season of Lent is this 40-day fast, skipping Shabbat. Okay, you fast 6 days a week, and on the seventh day you stop a fast. You are forbidden from fasting on the Sabbath. So today is a really good day for me. Okay. And you spend a little bit of extra time meditating on what God has done, trying to notice other people just that little bit more, how to have an extra bit more time spending in His Word, and trying to get that touch from the Lord. So that's the context of this season. Now the context of the Transfiguration. So in the portion of Luke that we just read on the Transfiguration, Jesus has already started His ministry. He's already gathered Himself some disciples, some students. He's becoming quite popular. Yes, the crowds, they love Him. Okay, he hasn't got as big a crowds perhaps as President Trump, but he didn't have stadiums back then. Okay, but he's very popular. He is healing people. He is fighting back the demons. And He is challenging the status quo. It is going well. And then in amongst this really good time, suddenly Jesus takes a small group of His followers. He takes three. How many disciples has Jesus got at this stage? Well, He's got 12 inner circle, but He's probably got even some more of that. He's got hundreds. No, following Him around, and some of them stay with Him for a full year, and some just stay with Him for a couple of years, and a bit of a cycle going on. Even the inner 12 change every year, right? That's every time you see a list in the New Testament, you see a different list of inner 12. And He takes three of them up on the mountain. What are the rest of the disciples doing? Well, they're not going up on top of the mountain. So what does that teach us? It teaches us, as followers of the Messiah, that not everybody gets to see the miracle. And that's okay. Sometimes in our tradition, or some parts of our tradition, we think that to be a follower of Jesus is to always see miracles. And it's great when they happen. It's great when you see it. But it's okay if you don't. And don't let anybody say that you're a better or a worse disciple. Because those same three people who walked up on top that mountain and saw Jesus transfigured and saw His glory are exactly the same three people that run away from the cross and abandon their master. So also notice that seeing a miracle doesn't always help your faith either. One of the things I also like doing is when we studied the book of Acts, we discovered that whenever Paul did a miracle, guess what happened to him? He got the stuffing beat out of him. And he'd never had a success in that city. When he went in and just had a little Bible study in the synagogue, planted churches. It should teach us something. The miracle isn't the faith. Your faith allows you to help see miracles. So Jesus takes these guys up on top of a tall mountain, which then begs the next question. Ooh, what mountain? And we don't really know, because the text doesn't tell us. I mean, it probably could have if it wanted to. I'm not sure if every single mountain in the Second Temple period was numbered or named. Some of them were. It is Oregon. Anyone heard of him? Okay, he's an early church father. He's the guy that came along and said it's Mount Tabor. And so we get the tradition, it's Mount Tabor, and then we build a church on top of it. Okay. There is another option. I prefer the Mount Hermon option, which you tend to, the mountain of the many, Hermon, which does have a tradition attached to it, but there's no church. Okay, and the tradition comes from some of those other books that are not in your Bible, they're in other people's Bibles. In this case, the Ethiopian one, the Book of Enoch, which describes that there are various places on this planet that have an extra special connection to heaven. It's that extra little closeness. Temple Mountain is one of them. Okay, Beit El, where Jacob gets to see a ladder and angels ascending and descending up and down. But the Mount Hermon, according to Enoch, was also a special place, special connection point. That was the assembly point for the angelic rebellion. So in Genesis 6, there's another rebellion from the Lord. This one is not led by what we call the devil, Satan. It's led by, doesn't even say who it's led by. Enoch expands on that, and it says that they gathered at Mount Hermon. Okay? And Hermon becomes quite famous in the conquest of Canaan, because that's where a lot of the giants lived. Okay, the guys like Sihon, about in Numbers and in Deuteronomy, had never moved far from Mount Hermon, where according to tradition they were descendants from those angels. So that was a gateway between heaven and earth, and it's possible that Yeshua went up there. And this scene, which we read, very similar to what we see in the Exodus. There is a mountain. There are lights. There's a fire. In Deuteronomy, Moses says that God spoke through that fire, and you all saw it. There's a cloud that comes and hovers over the mountain. There's a cloud that comes here as well. There are voices that you hear. And God appears, and there is glory. It's one of the parts of the text. You see the glory of God. Moses, in Exodus, when he's going up the mountain, he says to God, I want to see your glory. Show me your glory. And what does God say back? I'll show you my goodness. The glory of God is linked to his goodness. God is good. And his being good, his goodness, and the things that he does that are good, they will reflect his glory. So Lent is also about seeking the goodness of Jesus, the things that he has done, the things that he teaches his disciples to do, to see a transfiguration or a change in us, to be able to touch and also see the glory of the Lord. Now, in this transfiguration scene on this mountain, some men appear, Moses and Elijah. Why them? Good question. Once again, Oregon comes along, and he says, they represent the law and the prophets. Have you heard this teaching before? Comes all the way back from the church fathers, Oregon. Now, even though most of us probably don't read the church fathers, my personal favorite is Tertullian, a lot of our theology still comes from them anyway. Okay, so every time you say Moses and Elijah, people think automatically Law and the Prophets. Again, probably reading it from Wikipedia. I actually disagree with Oregon on this one. He loved allegory. He loved to allegorize absolutely everything. And so he saw Moses, he saw Elijah, and he turned those into allegory. Moses represents the law, and Elijah represents the prophets. And the problem with that allegory is that they're both prophets. Are they not? In fact, when God has his people and he's wandering them around the desert, he tells them, says, I've given you three prophets to lead you. Who are they? Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. That's right. We've got ourselves a female prophet there. And that the idea that, females were also prophets, well, everybody's supposed to be a prophet from the book of Joel, is you see a prophet in the temple. When Yeshua goes in there as a small baby, who does he meet? Anna from the tribe of Asher, and she's a prophetess, and she's been prophesying for a very long time. It also teaches us that prophecy had not departed from Israel, okay, which is usually what we're also told. There was and still is and should be the role of the prophet within our community. So they're both prophets. Elijah doesn't actually physically write a book. We don't know the book of Elijah. All of his adventures occur in Kings. What do they do? Both Moses and Elijah have a role to play in the Messianic kingdom. What's Moses' role? Well, someone like me is supposed to show up. Remember, that's what we see in Deuteronomy when he's giving his instructions to the children of Israel who are about to lead into the invasion into the Holy Land. And that book of Deuteronomy is a very interesting text. Moses starts his career by saying what? I don't know how to talk. Choose somebody else. And then 40 years later, you get the longest monologue in the entire Bible. So somewhere between I don't know how to talk and 40 years of wandering through the desert, Moses pretty much figured out how to talk. And as part of his speech, as part of his preparation and sort of, you know, getting the people ready, he makes a comment on the Bible. He takes the first four books and he makes a comment about them. And it's very interesting to discover what he leaves out, what he changes. Because when the people of Israel, they're standing in front of him. What's the first thing that the Israelites are going to do when they walk into Canaan? Yeah, well, one of them's forget. Joshua chapter 5, they're going to circumcise themselves. Ergo, are they circumcised when Moses is talking to them? Interestingly, no. You think, okay. So you've had the Mishkan, you've had Aaron the priest, you've had a whole bunch of other adventures, and none of you thought about actually circumcising yourselves? Moses forgot to circumcise. So Moses forgot to circumcise his own kids. And he's like, so what he does is he goes, you know what, we've had these rules, we're not really good at it, so which should we circumcise? Circumcise your heart. Write these laws on your heart. Okay, you find, when you read Deuteronomy, you discover there's lots of things where you take the Torah and you put it here. That doesn't negate the Torah. It just tells us where we should really, really, really put it. I mean, it's not really a really good battle plan, I think, to actually invade a new country, stand out front of Jericho, and then immediately start slicing bits off your body. Okay, but I could imagine that the Jericho people looked at the Israelites and went, these guys are nuts. No one go out there and fight them. Okay, but it's what happens. And then in Deuteronomy, Moses, as he's sharing with these uncircumcised Israelites, he says, one day, someone like me is going to come. And you have to listen to him. And so there was this eschatological idea that there's going to be a Moses-like figure that's going to come. And then Elijah, who's he? He also plays a role in the kingdom of heaven, in the eschatological messianic era. He's the forerunner. He is the herald. So here we have the herald, and here we have the one like Moses. And they're talking to Jesus. And what are they talking to him about? They're not talking about how well he's done. I mean, they may have. Okay? they talked. The text is very specific. They talked to him about his exodus. He goes up on top of this high mountain that has a connection, very close connection to God. And as Randy was talking to us last week, Jesus is still learning. They're talking to him about, you know what's going to happen. Let's talk about that. Let's work through some of this thinking. You're going to go to Jerusalem. You're going to face your death. Now, of course, too often in the Protestant world, or actually any Christian world, we think, yeah, you know, Jesus knew all this anyway for when he was in heaven, and he just came down here, and he did it, and he went back to heaven, and oh, it's okay. But did he really want to die? He willingly went to Jerusalem. He bravely turned his face towards Jerusalem. He accepted the challenge. And he knew from the scriptures, he's been discussing with Moses and Elijah and all through his life, he's learning that the Messiah is going to suffer and die. And yet, on the last night of his life on earth, what did he say? What did he say? If there's another way, I'll take it. Yeah. So yes, he's also, his human part of him is learning. They're having a really good discussion, these guys. Moses, Elijah, and Jesus, they're talking about, they're preparing him for his suffering, and he's willingly having to learn and listen and digest and work this through too. Suffering is a big deal on this planet. And it's a theological issue. A lot of people will not believe in God because of suffering. And that is a terrible piece of theology or any sort of excuse. Because even a secular world, that is, no one believes in God, they all acknowledge that suffering exists. It is very rare to find someone who says, oh, no, it's just all in your head. It's just a chemical reaction. That's all you are. Everyone knows that suffering exists. The problem is a secular world can't find any meaning for it. It exists, but there is no meaning. Only a religious worldview gives you a meaning to suffering. And you know it. Suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance produces character. Character produces hope. Suffering can, and many times does, but not always, lead to good. Even a secular worldview will acknowledge this, that I've got a sore tooth, I go to the dentist comes in and does some really not nice stuff to me, and I pay him and he buys another yacht, and then my mouth feels better. So yes, sometimes you can willingly go in and suffer knowing that there's a good result. And theologically, and from the text, we wrestle with the idea of suffering. And theologically, we come to the conclusion it can lead to a good thing. And in the New Testament, Paul, in his context, not the only one, but in his one, he said it produced hope. Your big screen TV doesn't produce hope, right? Except that maybe by the end of the week there's a nice show to see on Netflix. But that's pretty much it. Suffering produces something better in us, and it's a good thing. Might even help us to see the goodness of God. And so in this season of Lent, as disciples of the suffering Messiah, many believers, not everyone, will take upon themselves a little extra form of self-sacrifice, a little extra form of fasting or self-denial. They'll give up something, and it will produce a good thing. In his goodness, the Messiah will suffer. And he is preparing to do this. And so you see the glory of the Transfiguration. We're going to see the goodness of God, of what God is doing on this world. Why would God, in his goodness, send his son to die and suffer. How does that work? Theologically, it works. From a secular world, it makes no sense. It is, as Paul says, foolishness to Greeks. A stumbling block for Jewish people, because Messiah is supposed to be the conquering king. Supposed to be a strong character. In fact, you know, we were wrestling with this idea that when we read the texts, we see these very powerful figures, and they seem to do conflicting things. Some are powerful, some are warriors, and some suffer. And so we end up with the theology of the two messiahs, Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. That's a nice theological way to try and deal with it. Secular world can't even come there. All they can say is, we have no meaning for suffering. It leads nowhere. So your idea of a suffering God makes no sense to us. But for you and I, and you know it, you know that it does. You know that by his stripes we are healed. You know that by his suffering, goodness came back into this world. And you know that when he did it, we saw the glory of God. And that is a good thing. And so now, because of the suffering of the Messiah, we are going to have hope. I don't know what that conversation was on top of that mountain between Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. I can only guess or speculate. It is interesting that many times in the text, they give us these little glimpses of conversations, and they give us no data on what they actually said. My personal favorite is Jesus meets a couple of disciples on his way to Emmaus. Yes? And then while he's there, he has a fantastic Bible study where he goes through the entire Bible, the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, and describes where he's in the text. Just that he did it. And sometimes you go, oh, for crying out loud, did you have to put that in there? I mean, I'm glad you did it. It would have been nice if I could have known. Well, brothers and sisters, we wrestle with that. We're learning a little bit about what actually went on in that conversation. And I think we're learning a little bit as well about what Moses and Elijah talked and prepared Jesus for his exodus. That they would have had they might have started with something like, you know, boss, you're really pulling in the crowds here. Not 100% sure you were smart on choosing your disciples. You might want to choose some smart ones. I don't know how that would have gone. But then they would have prepared him and said, listen, we've been praying for you up here. You're not alone. There's some prophecies. It might hurt. Are you ready? Be prepared. But you're not alone, brother. You're not alone, master. This will work for the good of God. And for myself, as a follower of the Messiah, in my tradition, which is liturgical, and by name Anglican, I embrace this season of Lent. And so for a brief moment in time, for 40 days, I take upon the command that I found in Matthew 6 to fast, take upon that command to pray just that little bit more, to attend extra studies where I'm sort of compelled to pray, and acknowledge that I need to repent, and then prepare myself to join in the sufferings of the Messiah, knowing that in so doing, it will increase my character and at the end, fill my life with hope. And brothers and sisters, if there is anything that you and I have to give to this world, it is hope. Because without God, if there is nothing beyond death, when you close your eyes for the very last time, what hope do you have? None. They're hopeless. And they've got lots to panic about out there. do they not? But you and I have a hope to share. You can say, you and I, we believe that our Messiah is ruling and reigning. We believe that our King is sitting on the throne. We believe that he is somehow making it all better. It hurts sometimes, but it will always produce something good. So I'm taking this season of self-denial, a bit of interpersonal reflection, trying to be good, knowing and acknowledging that any suffering that I might bear or that I see my being borne by others, of which I hope that I can run to and share, will only bring good. And that, I think, from our Messiah, is good news. Our Messiah is preparing to suffer, but our Messiah is preparing to be most glorious. Amen.